The Knowledgeable Provider podcast is intended primarily to entertain, also to inform, but it is not a substitute for actual medical training and should not be used by anyone to diagnose or treat any medical condition in themselves or others. If you need medical advice, please make an appointment to see your own knowledgeable medical provider. The opinions expressed by me and anyone else who happens to appear on the podcast are solely those of the people expressing them and are not necessarily representative of any other entities. Other than the lunches at the office, I do not receive any sort of compensation from pharmaceutical or medical device companies, and I have no other relevant financial disclosures. Look, this is all for fun, okay? Don't sue me. All right, on with the show. Rob Daniels, welcome to Knowledgeable Provider. Thanks for your time, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to finally be here.
You want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Rob Daniels. I used to work for Huntsville Hospital in IT, mostly in the tech support area. So basically, when you had a problem, the face that you would see is what my position was. And I was there for about 4 years. And I didn't really have an IT background. Went to school for kinesiology, did a full 180 after college, and got into IT and was there for 4 years.
What led you to make that U-turn, or I don't know what you call it, left turn?
Yeah. A U-turn is probably a fair way to describe it, because definitely wasn't the direction I was going. I wanted to be a college basketball coach. And so my reasoning behind kinesiology was just, I wanted to be sure that when I became a coach, I knew the why behind everything that I was going to tell my players to do physically. So I knew, you know, the difference between anaerobic and aerobic exercise and why a baseball player doesn't need to run 3 miles in practice, because all they do is sprint and change directions really quickly. So anaerobic exercises are probably better for baseball players and things like that. So I really wanted to nail that down, but I got into coaching and it was just a lot of travel, and you pretty much are guaranteed to make little to no money for a good majority of the start of your career, at least. And I'd met Amelia, who's my wife now, and that wasn't something that I was interested in doing, and making no money and, you know, not being able to start a family. I got to Huntsville Hospital because they were in the transition from one EMR to another. So they just needed bodies in IT. They really just needed people that were willing to help and work hard. And so that's, you know, kind of where I got started. I was an intern making $10 an hour or something when I first started. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I ended up in IT.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and schedule you for your next podcast episode about kinesiology then.
That part of my brain has been dead for so long that there's no way I could help you or give you any insightful information in that area.
You just did. You just said more than I know about it. Right off the top, I want to ask, was there ever any time that your kinesiology training came into play when you were wandering around the hospital? Ever have any like emergency kinesiology interventions?
No. Fortunately, Huntsville Hospital's got plenty of people that knew way more than me in that regard. So, you know, they never needed my insight.
Which years were you at the hospital?
2018, 2022.
I might have just missed you then. I think I left the hospital in 2018. You showed up just in time to change EMRs and then have COVID.
Yeah, I got both of those experiences. So felt like I was in a fire drill just the entire time I was there. There was a piece of that was nice, you know. It was just like you didn't really have time to question anything. You had to learn, and you had to learn fast. And so I wouldn't want that to ever happen again. But yeah, it was a very fast-paced environment, and so I think it tested me a lot.
I bet. I always feel like I escaped the hospital just in the nick of time to miss both of those things.
Yes, and then I came right in behind you and just got both of them.
Well, that makes me feel better that I was never somebody who called you to come like plug in the monitor cable on my computer or like turn it off and back on or something.
Yeah. You don't think you ever had one of those experiences?
Oh, no. I just mean with you. I never had one. I was never the person that did that to you.
Yeah. Okay. So that we'll let that slide then. But yeah. Definitely had my fair share of emergencies, quote unquote, that ended up being 5-second fixes. So
I bet. Well, so I've been thinking about this since we decided to do this, and you know, it turns out I literally know nothing about that side of healthcare of IT. You know, I've always been just an end user, right? Like, I learn how to use the system enough to do my job, and I bitch about it when it doesn't work, and I don't know what happens behind the screen. So, can you just talk about just a general overview of like what happens on the other side? What does it take to run a system like at Huntsville Hospital?
I would say that you're in the majority of, you know, people that are end users, and they don't really notice anything unless it's going wrong, right? So, you know, I don't know that I could give you a full insight into how everything works, but I do know that there's so many different teams. Each team is dedicated to one specific silo. And I think in some regards, that's tough because you run into a lot of politics when you're trying to fix certain things, because there's just so many different teams that you'd have to navigate to. But in other regards, it's nice because you know that there's just so many different pieces working together with the goal in mind of making patient care as effective and just as good as possible, I guess. So as far as like, you know, how that works, I mean, you've got people who are, you know, testing the applications that you guys use on a daily basis, and you've got people, you know, communicating with, in the hospital's case, Cerner on almost a daily basis for, you know, workflow cases and things like that. But for my team, it was mostly hardware. So when Cerner came in, they said, hey, for our application to run effectively and optimally, your hardware needs to meet these specs. And so the hospital doesn't just randomly decide, oh, we're going to get this model right here with, you know, this much RAM and, you know, this much space on the drive. Like, there are certain specs that have to be met. And so that's how that kind of process is laid out. And then it's bought. And then I guess one of the things kind of pulling back the curtain on IT that, you know, some people probably don't know is that each computer that comes in has to be touched. Had to be touched by our team. You know, you can't just unbox it and plug it in and it has everything that you need. So we would actually have what's called an image, which is basically just like essentially it's an operating system that you've snapshotted to place onto another hard drive. And so that's what we do every time we get a device, we'd put that image on it so that it could have all of the hospital software and applications and preferences and security settings and patches like that. So, you know, we touched every single PC that came in and then we would deploy it. So that's kind of at a very high level, very quickly, kind of how things go on the back end.
How many computers are we talking about? How many were under your purview?
Just at like the main campus, including, you know, women's and children's, 8,000 about. That might include a few of the surrounding areas as well. But yeah, about 8,000.
So now is the IT department there at Huntsville, Maine, responsible for the outlying hospitals now that it's a huge health system?
No, like I know Helen Keller has their own, and you know a lot of the other ones have their own IT, and they communicate with each other a little bit. But I think from hospital to hospital, there may not be the same people calling the shots, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess they all had their own infrastructure and stuff in place before they were taken over.
Yeah, you got to kind of manage them a little bit separately.
So when I worked there at Huntsville, I think iCare was the main, the main system that everybody used. And then there were some different systems. Like I think ER had WellSoft, and then the surgery areas had some other thing. It was forever infuriating that none of those things ever talked to each other. So for instance, when I worked in the pediatric ICU, you know, a patient might come into the ER that we knew was going to come up to us. And so we would want information, but we couldn't get into their system, WellSoft, and we couldn't see anything in any of that in iCare. So it was always just this gigantic pain. But so my understanding is now that everybody uses Cerner, right? It's all one thing.
Yeah, that's correct. And like just you describing your situation is mind blowing to me. I can't imagine how the hospital operated effectively in that manner, just without different departments being able to communicate basic information like who this person is and what's wrong with them. I can imagine that was infuriating. So fortunately, on my end, I guess I drew the short end of the stick with COVID and Cerner. I guess the crossover to Cerner, but the plus side is we didn't have to deal with any of that because, you know, everyone was using Cerner. You know, each department could communicate or pull up data relatively easily. And I think that was a big reason why the transition happened, because enough people complained about the use case that you just gave. It's enough people were like, yeah, I don't think it should be that way.
Right. It makes sense. And I wasn't there long enough to see how the system we had in place developed. I would assume it's like we upgrade one system this year and then 10 years later, another department wants something. I assume that's how it got piecemealed together, but I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, it's probably something along those lines.
You mentioned that the software requirements sort of determine what hardware you end up getting. How much is involved as far as like politics and dealing with administration and who all gets to have input on that when you're working on a change or an upgrade?
It's just like any organization. I think it starts at the top and those decisions and discussions are had at the highest level and then just kind of trickle down to us. So, you know, we weren't very involved in the selection process. We were more just told this is what's got to happen. I'm sure, you know, my manager at the time was probably involved in a few of those conversations just to give an input. But I don't know that there was a ton of politics involved in like maybe necessarily purchasing and things of that nature. I think for me, the time that, you know, politics were most evident, and I've kind of mentioned this previously, is just how each team is kind of siloed a little bit. So having to maneuver through all of those hoops can be pretty frustrating. It was frustrating for me, and I knew who to go to for everything. So I can imagine, you know, for a nurse who doesn't know who to go to, having to jump around from team to team for the same issue would be really frustrating. And so I felt for them in that regard. And that I think that's where the politics kind of reared its ugly head the most frequently, or at least the easiest to see. Like, for example, I don't know if at y'all's office or at the hospital you ever saw those like Welch Allyn devices that are, they're on wheels and they basically, I believe they can just, you know, read a patient's vitals and they're connected to the internet. And, you know, you'd get a ticket and saying the device isn't working. Well, okay, there's a biomed team who's in charge of looking at the medical devices that are connected to the hospital network. There's, you know, my team who looks at internet connectivity. Are our access points, our wireless network, is it communicating effectively? And then there's also like the infrastructure team who, if both of those things seem to be okay, then, you know, is there a problem in one of the switch closets? So like just having to bounce between team to team for one issue and not knowing who to go to, I'm sure was super frustrating.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. And that's funny. Those little machines, you know, they're just kind of spread around everywhere and they get kicked around, knocked around. You know, they get used constantly. It's one of those like, did you ever hear that thing about the guy that went on the mission to say thank you to everybody that had a hand in making his morning cup of coffee and ended up going all over the world to, you know, it led him down this huge path of all everybody who grew the beans and everybody did this. And, you know, me as a clinical person, I would not think about that at all. Just that one little piece of equipment, how much goes into keeping up with that?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot. And it doesn't just end there. Like, you know, you think about in patient rooms, is the computer on the wall or is it a cart that is mobile? Where is it in the patient room? If it is mounted on the wall, like where is it? All of those things were communicated before the building was ever, you know, physically there. Like when the blueprints were being written up, they were talking about where's the computer going. So you're right. It goes further back than any of us can really begin to imagine or have time to think about in our day-to-day work day.
And I'm sure it's a whole other conversation about retrofitting older buildings when you go to put in stuff that was not even around when the thing was designed, you know?
Yes, 100%. That's always difficult because technology is always going to move, you know, progress much faster than building infrastructure. So, and you know, how things were laid out in the 80s versus the technology today. So yeah, you're exactly right about that.
How much input do you guys get from clinical staff as far as, well, even things like that, like where are we going to put this computer or like what kind of machines do we need or what things do we need to avoid or what features do we want? Like how much input from the clinical side goes into those decisions when they're being made?
I think a lot. At the end of the day, we're just here to support the system and we're here to support the hardware, but we're not the ones that are using it every day and we're not the ones that have to use it while in high stress situations like taking care of patients and things like that. So I think it's really important that you speak to the people that are in those situations every day. And I do think the hospital does a good job of communicating with department heads about, like you're saying, even the physical location of the device, all the way to, you know, what we're going to be doing on it. And IT actually has employees at the hospital that were, that used to be nurses for that reason, so that they can have sort of like an inside look into, hey, you know, you've got experience in both of these worlds. Like, how can we join them together?
I've been curious about whether the kind of the IT side of things is aware of how much that affects our day-to-day workflow, you know, because as sad as it is to say, we probably spend at least as, or it feels like we spend at least as much time sitting in front of a computer charting as we do actually, you know, doing what we're trained to do, which is take care of patients. And like when the, you know, like for instance, when there's downtime, when one of the systems is down, it's just, it's a nightmare. You wouldn't think it would affect anything. Like, you know, I'm trained to take care of a patient and the charting should be way on down the line, but it's not. Like that whole, it goes into the whole like flow of your day and how everything's working. And I forgot where I was going. Now I'm just bitching.
Yeah, now you're,
now you know what it was like to talk to me at the hospital, right?
Yeah, now I'm the face of IT and you're just yelling at me. No. If you're not aware of how, I guess, affected people's workday is by, and their ability to adequately provide patient care, like you should be aware of those things. If you're working in IT, I would like to think that most people are. But yeah, at the end of the day, like that's our job, is to provide support so that people can adequately provide exceptional patient care. And if that is threatened, then, and it's a technology issue, then that's when we need to step in. So you definitely need to be aware of that. And if you're not, then you're probably not in the right place.
So if I'm a staff member working in a hospital and I have an idea for, hey, you know, I read about this, maybe we could implement this, or, you know, I think it'd be cool if we had this piece of equipment or if we added this functionality or whatever, like, who do I talk to? How do I go about trying to implement something like that?
I'd like to think that their ears are always open. The one caveat I would give to that is, you know, just make sure it's important. Like I said, at the end of the day, IT is there to help facilitate excellent patient care through the use of technology. If you feel like an idea that you have can improve that, then sure, get in touch with IT and, you know, you can get that ball rolling. But don't call with the request like, Friday, you used a mouse at this nurse station and it was this size. And then you came in Monday and it was a little bit bigger and you don't like that. And like, you're laughing, but those kind of requests come in and you would think they're life and death. So as long as people feel like, you know, patient care can be improved through the use of technology, then yeah, absolutely bring it up. The people in IT would definitely lend a listening ear to that. Now, will they implement it? Maybe not. There's always the politics as far as like cost and, you know, who's going to buy it? Is it going to be us? Is it going to be you guys? I know that can get a little bit frustrating, but there's not like an official chain for that. I think it's just getting in touch with, you know, the people that you feel like can at least get the conversation started.
Okay. Tell me about the stupid complaints.
I mean, I don't know that we have enough time for that, but there's a lot. I mean, most of them are just your preference things. Like I can think of one specific area. I can tell you the exact, like I could walk to the computer today at the hospital if you let me in the front door. I could find it. And there were two different secretaries, I guess one that worked on the weekend and one that worked on the weekdays, or maybe one in the day, one at night, something like that. And each one of them wanted their screen resolution to be different, but neither one of them knew how to do that. Or really, we don't want people to know how to do that because of this exact reason, because everyone has different preferences. So one would call and say, hey, you know, I can't read anything. It's too small. Can you make it bigger? And so whoever was on night shift would come make it bigger. And then Monday you'd get a call. This is too big. I can't. And
oh, no.
It was just like I can't tell you how many consecutive weeks those work orders just like over and over. So yeah, just little things like that. And that goes back to what we were just talking about. Like if it doesn't really affect like patient care or your ability to do your job, and it's just like a preference, then maybe hold off.
Any other specific examples of dumb requests that you can remember?
There's just so many, like not knowing where the power button is on your computer or your monitor. You know, get a work order saying that the computer's dead, and you get there and the monitor's just turned off. So there's always that. There's always the mouse isn't working, mouse wasn't plugged in, things like that. So it's pretty standard. And, you know, you try to laugh it off. I mean, it's fine as long as people have a sense of humor, and most of the time they did. most of those people wouldn't make that mistake twice because they'd think, you know what, I'm going to check before I call IT next time because I don't want to be embarrassed like I just was. But, you know, they're not, they don't work in IT. So, you know, you can't hold it against them, but it was pretty funny. I may or may not have held it against a couple of people.
Were people nice to you? Or, I mean, for the most part, were people ever like really insanely mean to you?
Yeah, generally people are really nice, particularly like hospital staff was always really kind. At the end of the day, like you need help. So, I mean, there were a few times where, you know, people would might give you some attitude and it's like, I mean, do you want me to help you or not? So I think most people, you know, had a good way of looking at it and just appreciated that we were there to help. You know, I tried to respond in a timely manner too. So people knew like I'm not sitting around waiting till the end of the day to do this. Like I know it's important to you. So I'm going to get there as fast as I can. And so I hope people recognize that when I was there, but patience would give me some problems sometimes. And I get it. Like if I'm in the worst pain I've ever been in my life, or I just got told some really terrible news that I'm going to have to live with for the rest of my life. And, you know, some goofball is knocking on my door while I'm trying to take a nap, telling me that he needs to fix the computer. Like, I don't know that I would have the best attitude either. So, you know, I wouldn't take it personal, but yeah, patients probably gave me more flack than any medical staff did for sure.
Any interesting specific experiences there that you can remember with patients?
Oh yeah, there's so many. My first week at the hospital, I want to say like my first two or three days, I was given a list of ICU rooms that I needed to go in and just check a few things. And like the second door that I went in that particular day, there was just like a grandma getting a sponge bath and, you know, all her glory. So that was like, oh, all right, I definitely work at a hospital. So that was kind of a wake up call. There was another instance where a gentleman was, did not want to be at the hospital. He woke up, kind of came to, realized where he was, you know, ripped out his IV. There's blood going everywhere. He proceeds to use the bathroom on the floor, both number one and number two, and just walked out. I guess that's what they call leaving AMA. And I was just like, I'm so glad that I'm not a nurse and that I can leave the situation whenever I want. So it definitely, I do think it gave me a new appreciation for medical staff and just the things that have to be endured on a day-to-day basis. Like for me, that's a wild story that just came to my mind, you know, because I'll never see anything like that again. But for a nurse on that unit, that's just Tuesday. So that's wild. And so the patience that it requires to deal with that every day is something that I do not possess. So I never, you know, pursued a medical career for many, many reasons. And that is one of them.
Yeah. I was always very jealous of the different specialties and people that got to come into the unit, do something and then go away. Respiratory therapy. Those are the best jobs.
Yes. You come check on your patient, make sure they're doing okay. And then you get out of there.
Absolutely. Did you ever have to clean any excrement out of a machine?
No.
Is that
no,
a thing that happens?
No, I'm not going to say no, because it definitely could. And there's definitely times where I had to clean something off of, you know, I'd be like in there and I noticed there was something on the keyboard or something on the screen. And it's one of those things like, I'm just not even going to ask anybody what this is. I'm just going to clean it and wash my hands thoroughly when I leave and not ask any questions. I think there were a few cases where it might have been someone spilled like medicine or something. Nothing too crazy. If I ever saw feces or urine, I'm out. Like, this ain't the room for me. Not today.
Do the IT employees have to go through the like biohazard, you know, training how to deal with body fluids and all that?
I had to go through the same orientation that everyone else had to go through, so medical staff included. So I'm sure we went over that. It's probably bad that I can't remember. I just remember in that orientation spending like 30 minutes talking about how to wash your hands and how important sure. that is. It's important, but I'm sure we had to do something along those lines. I know my manager asked before I took the internship, are you okay? Like, how do you feel around blood? Like, does blood make you uncomfortable? Does it make you woozy type deal? And that was a deal breaker for him in the IT department. If you said, like, I can't handle blood, then well, we can't hire you because you're going to encounter something like that. Yeah, what comes to mind is, yeah, there's an incident in the ER where I believe someone had been working near a gas pipe and it had burst. And I was working in the room, which was empty when I started doing what I was doing. And it was one of those ordeals where I couldn't stop in the middle of, like, I had to complete my task in order for that machine to be operable. And he came in and, like, was basically missing a face. I mean, just blood everywhere. That's when I was like, yeah, he wasn't lying. You're going to encounter some of this stuff.
Did you ever see anything that really bothered you, like that stuck with you?
I don't know if that there's one thing in particular that sticks with me. I do remember being, I don't know if bothered is the right word, but I didn't have any goals of getting into the medical field. So being around like death and like pain and suffering every day was never something that crossed my mind when I thought about my future professional career. I'm sure you did to some degree, right? Like, you just know that that's just part of the job.
Sure.
But for me, that wasn't something that I was really prepared for. And so I do think that there was a time where, you know, I had to kind of acknowledge, like, oh my gosh, like, I'm seeing a very small amount of what happens at the hospital, but it was affecting me just being around death so much. You know, I had an incident where I was like working on a computer and the patient died within seconds of me being in there. I had incidents where I would strike up a good conversation with a guy and I'd come back the next day for, you know, something, and I would overhear that, you know, he had passed the night between us talking. And so that was strange. I was pretty young, you know, I went straight from college where, you know, the most important thing in my world was like a college football game to seeing that kind of stuff every day. Definitely stuck with me.
Yeah. And I guess that's something, I mean, I guess I can only speak for myself, but I would think that most clinical people, it doesn't really occur to us that all the other ancillary, is that a derogative term? All the other folks that work at the hospital who are not clinical people, it wouldn't necessarily register with me that you guys would be affected by that sort of thing too.
Yeah, I definitely, you would think it happens with other people. Maybe I'm just weird, but no one went to school for, you know, to be an electrician or to be working computer science or anything like that, thinking that they would encounter death regularly, you know, like the plant ops and, you know, the EVS and all those people. Like, I'm sure there's got to be people that it affects a decent amount.
After you've moved on from the hospital, how's that experience probably influenced your career since then?
I think it helped me a lot. And just, I guess, as far as professionalism and just dealing with people, I feel like I have a lot more patience than I did when I first started at the hospital, because, you know, you're dealing with nurses who are going through a stressful time because they have several patients. You're dealing with doctors who are trying to, you know, help those patients as much as they can. You're dealing with patients and their families who might have just heard the worst news that they'll ever hear or be having the worst day of their lives. And so I think just having empathy for people and just maintaining professionalism through varying circumstances, I think that was really helpful for me as I moved on in my career. Because I didn't go to school for IT. I didn't really plan on staying in that field. So I'm no longer in that field. But I do think that, you know, being able to just support people, you know, regardless of how they treat me, I guess, which I don't know if it's a bad thing. Maybe that means I get walked all over in my job now. But I'd like to think that it just allows me to do the work and not worry about, you know, how I'm treated or, you know, second guess people's motives.
You know, sometimes being in the hospital, I think we interact with the computers and stuff so much and the network and stuff so much, we sort of forget that we're at work. And, you know, sometimes people do a little shopping or who knows what else on the hospital network. Did you ever have any experience with that?
Yes, absolutely. I think what people need to understand, and most of the younger generation know this, but maybe some of the older folks don't. If you are on an organizational device, okay, or if you're on a personal device on an organization's network, everything that you're doing is being tracked, always. There is someone that can see the website you're going to. They can see the app that you're using on your phone. They can see how long you were on the app, and they can see the MAC address of the device that you're using to access the app or the website. And they can also see, you know, is that a repeat? Is that MAC address like a repeat offender? Is it here Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. every week? Or is it a patient who's, you know, oh, they showed up once on a Wednesday and then we haven't seen them in 3 years. So basically they can narrow it down to, is it an employee or is it a patient? So yes, everything that you do is being monitored. You know, I wouldn't say closely, but if depending on, you know, the things that you're looking at or the things that you're doing, it might get flagged as something that needs to be monitored a little bit closer.
What kinds of things would be flagged? Just asking for a friend.
You can divide sites into categories on the back end of things. So you can filter to adult websites or things like that, social media, streaming services. So you can have these categories. And if somebody continually visits those at all, it can be flagged immediately. Probably streaming services and adult websites are the top two. You know, you don't want people on Netflix for 3 or 4 hours a day at the hospital. You just don't, like, that's not okay. You have a job to do. So that's not something that needs to be happening. And then I think I just can't even fathom, you know, visiting an adult website at work, but there are people that do, and rest assured, people know that you're doing it. If you're on a organizational device or on an organizational network.
That's a common thing, huh? Employees looking at porn while they're at work in the hospital.
It is much more common than I thought it could be. Yeah. So I guess there are people that are just not shy about the things that they're doing while they're at work.
Did you ever have to confront anybody, or did you ever have to provide information about somebody that was doing that sort of thing?
I've never had to confront anybody about that specifically, but just to go a little bit more big brother on you, we could actually track the exact location where it's happening as well. So there was an instance where someone was on Hulu for a really long time and found the MAC address, found out the closet that they were sitting in, and that person was confronted. It's a very awkward situation because they know they're in the wrong and we're there to tell them, like, hey, stop. So
that wouldn't go through their manager? That would actually, like, you would be directly responsible for that?
Technically speaking, that probably should have been a case where, like, we would have reported that to the manager because they're violating the employee handbook. But in that particular case, we just kind of wanted to scare them a little bit and say, like, hey, we can see what you're doing. We know exactly what you're doing, and we can find the closet that you're sitting in while you're doing it. So stop. And it worked. He didn't do it again.
And, you know, we're laughing about it, but I mean, seriously, you don't want your people who are supposed to be taking care of patients spending their time doing that crap.
No. And in this case, it was, it wasn't someone who was, you know, directly caring for a patient. So there's that. But yeah, you know, you don't want that. There's a reason that those things are put in place. It's not because, you know, work doesn't want you to have a good time while you're at work. It's because you're there to do a job. And in the case of a hospital employee, everything revolves around patient care. And if you're not doing something to positively affect patient care, then you're wasting time. And if you're doing something like watching Hulu in the closet for 3 hours, that's just not okay. You know, if I had a grandparent in the hospital, I wouldn't want to know that somebody was doing that, hiding somewhere in the closet. Like, it's important to me that every single person, you know, we talked about the guy thanking everybody for his cup of coffee. Like, I want everyone on that line to be doing everything that they can to make sure that my loved one is getting the best care possible, from the person that, you know, is cleaning the room before he gets there to the IT professional, to the doctor that's, you know, prescribing him medicine. So
I read or heard about a case recently where I think a patient died in the operating room. And one of the things that they did as part of the investigation was look at what all the staff members were doing on their phone, you know, while the case was happening, like who was on their phone screwing around, not paying attention. So it can range from just, you know, silly hijinks to, hey, you fucked up and killed a patient because you were screwing around on your phone and we can prove that, you know, that's not funny at all.
No. And that's life changing. Like your life is forever different because you decided that your Hulu TV show was more important than patient care in that moment. And you're forever affected by that decision now.
Sort of like texting and driving. Like it's not a big deal until it is.
Right. Exactly.
What about people doing things that compromise the security of the hospital system?
That's a struggle that every single organization all over the country has these days with how common, you know, phishing attempts are and things of that nature. We've discussed the different silos of IT. There was a dedicated security team that was in charge of facilitating information about possible phishing attempts. And you could actually forward malicious emails, suspicious emails to an account to be investigated. I'm sure that there are instances, the security team kind of keeps to themselves in that regard. You know, they don't exactly publicize that that's happening. But it is a fact, though, that hospitals are the main target for a lot of like ransomware attacks. Or I don't know if they're the number one target, but they fall for it. They're the number one victim. Healthcare is. So I know it's definitely on the forefront of everyone's mind in IT, especially in healthcare organizations right now. But, you know, I don't have any specific examples of that happening just because, like I said, that was a different team and, you know, they don't really publicize when it happens. But, you know, there are instances where things get caught and, you know, hardware has to be confiscated and there's a whole procedure for it in which, you know, the security team then gets the hardware and can do a little bit of, I guess, forensic analysis to some degree, and figure out who the culprit is and how they got in and what exactly they got when they got in, how long they've been in, things of that nature.
Yeah, and I've read or heard that hospitals especially are very soft targets because you have all those different little devices around that are connected to the internet with very minimal security.
Yeah, I mean, anything that has a connection to the internet can be hacked. Anything. I mean, you know, you've heard those stories of like baby cameras being hacked in people's houses and, you know, people talking through them. Yeah, like you're saying, you know, there's so many things in a hospital and there's so many people that if you, you know, I would assume that the reason that they're a good target is because there's so many people, you're bound to find someone who's going to slip up if you just keep trying. It's unfortunate that there's, you know, people out there that are that messed up in the head to target a place like that. But that's just the reality we live in.
And I would assume an organization like a hospital would be more willing to just pay to make it go away because they kind of need all that stuff to work.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I know like the FBI tells people, you know, they do not advocate paying the ransom because there's never any guarantee that they'll give you your data, like access to your data again. And there's never any guarantee that, you know, they won't ask for even more money. But a lot of organizations end up giving in for exactly that reason. Like they can't operate on downtime for that long. And hospitals, yeah, I would imagine that actually is probably the number one reason that they are the target of ransomware attacks. Cause those people, those malicious actors on the other end know at the end of the day, these people, they use the fact that everyone at that organization values patient care more than anything as a weapon.
Yeah. Very sad, very scary.
Yeah, it's crazy how often that's happening nowadays. And the crazy thing about those attacks is, I mean, you think of like any other type of investigation that goes on, you know, say you claim that you got hit or something. Well, people are just going to investigate that and they can look in Huntsville, you know, for the culprit. But with cyber attacks, you have no idea. It's usually more than one actor and they're in the Middle East or Asia or Europe, you know, somewhere in a basement. And, you know, how do you, I don't understand. That's way above my head and my pay grade to figure that stuff out. But kudos to those people that are, you know, always working on that.
You had to take call when you worked at the hospital, right?
Yeah, I did. We had like a little bit of a rotation, so it wasn't often. It was probably just a handful of times while I was there. But yeah, that is something that we would do.
What was it like being on call?
Generally, you know, you don't get a whole lot of calls just because it feels like, you know, in the middle of the night, there's just not as much activity on the computers going on. Like nurses, it's not to say they're not working, but like if they did run into an issue, they could always just hop to the other computer. Whereas the day shift workers, you know, there's doctors running in and out. There's, you know, respiratory therapists, things of that nature. So a computer may not always be open. So they would call immediately. At night, you kind of got your pick of the litter. You can pick any computer, you know, near your patient room to chart. So the calls that I would get were usually some of those odd requests that we were talking about earlier. I guess odd, I mean, they were dumb requests. The one that comes to mind is I was hanging out with my father-in-law, got a call that a computer was not working. And this particular computer was pretty important to that unit. And it needed to be on at all times. And so I said, okay, I'll drive out there. And this was at Madison Hospital. So it took me like 30, 35 minutes to get out there from where I live. And I ended up getting there and, the computer was just turned off. So I just pressed the power button and I pressed the power button and told her, you know, everything's okay and have a nice day and walked out. And I probably was a little upset walking to the car after that I had to stop doing what I was doing on like a Saturday night, to fix that.
Were you salaried or were you paid hourly?
Hourly. Yeah. I think everyone on my team was hourly just because with the Cerner transition and just like all of the hours that you could work. Yeah, we don't want to clock out if terrible things are happening, right? You want to stay. And so I guess the hospital is gracious enough to allow those employees to be hourly because, you know, if something bad happens where we end up having to put in a 15, 16 hour day, we would get paid for all of those.
Yeah, that's good. Was there an on-call pay and like, was there a different pay structure for that when you were on call?
Yeah, it was small. It was like a couple dollars an hour or something, regardless of if you got called. And then if you did get called, you were paid for 2 hours, regardless of the time you were there. Unless it exceeded 2 hours, then you were paid for, you know, as long as you were there. But so in that particular instance that I just told you, I was there for about 15 seconds and got paid for 2 hours. So that's kind of how I balanced the anger a little bit when I was walking out. You know, couldn't be too mad.
Sure. Yeah, that's the same thing that we got for being on call as well. Same deal. If you got called in, you tried everything you could to get out of there before 2 hours, so you'd be sticking it to the man a little bit. One thing that has struck me listening to you is that it's interesting how similar, in some respects, how similar your experience is to working on the clinical side, because it's kind of the same, like, you're just putting up with a bunch of bullshit all the time. You know, you're trained to do all this stuff and mostly what you're doing is just a bunch of crap and just trying to deal with that and wade through it and, you know, be nice and smile. And that's very, very similar to my experience on the clinical side too.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would argue that most jobs have to deal with that in some capacity, maybe not to the level of a hospital employee. But yeah, that's just what it is. I mean, just wade through the crap and the garbage that you don't really want to deal with. And at the end of the day, like in the case of the hospital, I know I've said it 100 times, but like it was just drilled into us that patient care is the utmost priority. So there's going to be things thrown at you that you're not going to love. But if you keep that in mind, that you're there to, you know, ultimately support the people that are going through really hard times in their lives and make their time at the hospital as easy as possible, then you know, you've done something right. And I would imagine, you know, you guys feel that way too. It's like you chose that career for a purpose, right? And you wanted to help people. And so with all the crap that comes with it, you're still doing it. And a lot of people stick in the medical field for a really long time. Y'all have to put up with way more than I could possibly imagine. But at the end of the day, you're there to help people.
That's interesting. You said that about every job is the same way. I've never done anything but medicine, so that's interesting to hear you say that.
I mean, I've worked in sports and then IT, and now I'm a data analyst. So I've done, I guess, 3 different things. And yeah, every job has their own garbage that you just got to sift through. And as long as you just keep your eye, I mean, I don't want to say keep your eye on the prize. It's so cliche, but like kind of. I mean, just you've got a goal and stay focused on that. And in the case of working at a hospital, it doesn't matter what department you work in. At the end of the day, you're there to support the patient and their families.
I know IT is not your thing anymore, but do you have any kind of sense of how AI might impact the healthcare sector as far as from a technology point of view?
I don't know about necessarily from a technology point of view. I do think that there's probably some concern back to the security conversations that we are having. Like AI is learning based on the input that you give it, right? So if I am a nurse and I don't want to ask someone a question that I feel like they're all going to make fun of me for, or I'm dumb, and I put in like some sensitive patient information to ChatGPT to try and get like this is some advice. Okay, well now ChatGPT has that personally identifiable information, and like that's not something that needs to be shared with them. So I think maybe from a security standpoint, that's probably something that's being monitored and discussed in the healthcare world. You know, even at the organization I work at now, like security is a big worry for ChatGPT, because, you know, kind of like we were talking about earlier, like there are people that surf organizational networks and don't realize they're being tracked. Well, there are people that are putting things into ChatGPT and they have no idea that ChatGPT is absorbing that information and holding on to it forever.
I'd never thought about that, people might actually risk patients' identities, you know, interacting with something like that. I'm very open to it. I love the idea of typing in symptoms and getting a differential diagnosis, but we haven't done anything to implement any kind of AI in our practice. And I've never actually interacted with ChatGPT. I'm chicken.
I think it's neat. AI is not a person, though. It is flawed in that regard. You just need to take their answers with a grain of salt. A lot of times, the answer that it spits out is not something that's helpful for me. But it does kind of lead me in the right direction and push me down the right path to get to the solution. So I guess in the medical field, you wouldn't use it as like a diagnosis, but maybe like to kind of help get those wheels turning in your head for maybe going down towards what eventually is the correct diagnosis.
I like the idea that patients would be able to get more accurate information about things. You know, one of the classic things that patients say all the time is, I know you guys don't like us to Google things. I know we're not supposed to Google, but like, why wouldn't you? All the information is out there. If you're curious about some medical thing, why wouldn't you go Google it? You know, it'd be nice if there was a source that everybody could actually trust.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess my follow-up question would be, what are some ways, like as someone who does work in the medical field, that you feel like AI could be implemented? And that's a good example.
I think medicine in general is still trying to figure out, like, is this going to take our jobs or, you know, is there some way we can integrate this? And I think it's probably coming whether we like it or not. So I hope everybody will be open to it and try to implement it in a positive way.
Yeah, for sure.
So just me as a clinical person, like, what's a good clinical person from an IT point of view? Like, what can I do to make your job easier? What can I do so that you don't hate me when I call you?
Oh, that's a good question. That's like every IT guy's dream, is to get that question. So I hope I don't fumble the answer here, but I think specificity is important when you're calling IT. So just understand, you know, if you call and say, my computer isn't working, well, that's like our whole job in one sentence. So I'm going to need a little bit more description. That'd be like a patient coming in and all they can tell you is, I don't feel good. That can't really help me, like help me help you, you know? So say, hey, I keep opening this application, I'm getting this error message, and then it crashes and I'm unable to use it. All right, well, that helps me a lot. I know where to start there. Or every time I go to print, I get this exact error message. Here's a screenshot of it. And it happened at this time, and this is what I was doing. You know how hard it is to help someone when they're not specific about the things that are wrong with them versus when they come in and say, hey, I was working on the roof and I fell off and my back really hurts now. Like you would know exactly where to go with that.
That's a great point. Dude, we have the same job. Y'all work on computers, we work on people. It's the same job. That's what I've been struck by most from this conversation. We do the same thing.
It is not the same thing. Your job is way cooler and way more important, and that the money follows that. So you can't debate me on that. But I do think there are some similarities, but no, the people that are actually on the front line facing the patients and dealing with them are so much cooler than us IT guys that are just hiding in the background and can run whenever somebody talks about peeing on the floor.
Well, thank you on behalf of the medical profession for the compliment, I guess. But I'll tell you, when those damn computers don't work, it is a nightmare and it's the worst day ever. So you guys keeping all that stuff running is key to the whole situation.
It's team effort. I mean, that's really what you learn when you're at the hospital, is like everybody's there for a common goal and everybody's got a job to do and a role to play. And ultimately, if everyone just stays focused on their task and their goal, then, you know, hopefully it's a smooth operation at the hospital.
Any parting words, take home points?
Just be nice to your IT guys. They're trying, I promise. I will say there are a lot of people that don't understand that, like, at the hospital, at least, help desk is not the same as the person that actually comes to deal with your problem. Help desk is there to facilitate it to the correct silo once they receive the call. But there were a lot of times where people would be like, I explained this to you on the phone and you gave me attitude. And I'm like, whoa, I was not on the phone with you. So like, whatever beef you had with that guy, it's not me. So let's start fresh here.
Did you ever have to do the help desk thing?
I did not. No, I did not. And I could not.
I felt very sorry for the help desk people.
Yeah. I mean, you're sitting there all day answering a phone and all their conversations are recorded. They work in this dungeon. There's this big screen up that shows like who's taking the next call and things like that. And it's just, I'm like, no, I could never work there. I'm glad I never had to. But there, I did work with some people that started at help desks and they much preferred, you know, our team.
I'd imagine so. Yeah. You could always tell that the people answering the help desk phone generally sounded like they hated life at that moment.
Yeah. There were a lot of people that knew that it was different, and I would always show up to the issue and hear about how terrible the phone conversation was. I'm just like, I'm sorry. You know, hopefully it gets better, but yeah, you got to feel for them. They're sitting in that dark room all day long, answering calls.
Yeah, probably mostly stupid calls too.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
I was definitely a person who had to call all the time and ask for my password to be reset.
That's something that they at least know exact. Like everyone there knows how to do that on day one. So that's not too bad.
I'm not going to say I never made a stupid call to IT, but I can't remember any specific examples off the top of my head. I don't know a lot about computers, but I can at least check the cables and make sure the power's on and all that.
Honestly, the people that called and had the just ridiculous phone calls were usually repeat offenders. Like we would know as soon as we saw their name on a ticket, it was like, oh boy, this ought to be, there's no telling what's wrong with the computer. It could say one thing and it'd be something completely different. So you just kind of get to know the people in your zone and establish a relationship with them and understand like, okay, he's that guy that hits the panic button no matter what.
Frequent flyers. There's another similarity.
There you go. Yeah, I guess you guys got people that are just coming in for all sorts of things. They have a different excuse for why they're there every time.
Absolutely. Same job. Who knew? We do the same job.
You're not. I don't like, let the record show. I have denied that comparison every time. Medical staff are way cooler and way more important than IT.
I'm going to edit that out, but duly noted.
Okay.
Is there anything else you want to talk about? What didn't I ask you that I should have asked you?
No, I think you covered it. I really enjoyed this and I had a great time.
I had a great time too. I appreciate it so much. I want to talk to you for the rest of the night, but we both have to go to work tomorrow. So.
Yeah, we got to do something tomorrow, I guess.
Well, hey, thanks for your time, man. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did too. Have a good one.
You too.
All right, bye.
All right, that does it for this episode of Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to like or subscribe or follow and leave a nice 5-star review. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients, in that order. The people.